Hi, my name is Andrew Gunawala. Welcome to the Brain Bag Podcast. We are releasing this episode a day early because we are covering the tragic events in Moscow. More than 133 people were killed. About more than 100 others were injured, at least as of this Saturday afternoon. These are the latest numbers that I have read. At basically this Moscow concert venue. The Russian authorities have asserted that they have arrested around 11 people, four people who were directly involved in that attack. Essentially, four of these guys went in with heavy guns and just started shooting and massacring these people at this concert venue, just in droves. And ISIS-K, which I believe is ISIS's Afghan branch or ISIS Khorasan, they claimed responsibility for this terrorist attack. US intelligence services have also asserted that ISIS-K is responsible for this attack. I also know that the US put out a warning on March 7th, warning of potential terror attacks on crowded areas, specifically also calling out concerts. And US officials have also stated that they did warn the Russian government about the potential for an attack. It's just a terrible, terrible event. Putin gave a statement. He tried to do some linkages with Ukraine. The Ukrainian government, of course, denied this. But to talk further on this, I brought my friend and mentor, Javed Ali. Javed was the former National Security Council Senior Director of Counterterrorism in the late 2010s. Great expert. And Javed, thanks for coming back on the Burn Bag. I think it's been a while as well.
Andre, always good to be with you on the burn bag, even though we're talking about a really tragic set of events based on the attack in Moscow.
Yeah. So, Javed, what are your first reactions to this attack? I mean, what were your first thoughts as we sort of came to confirm that this was indeed an ISIS attack?
So, once we saw the ISIS claim of responsibility, that then started to lead to a bunch of different questions. Was this one of the first questions I had when the initial reports were coming out? Was this a more localized ISIS branch, like ISIS of the Caucasus? And I do believe in the aftermath of the establishment of the self-declared caliphate in Iraq and Syria that there was an ISIS branch in the Caucasus, made up of probably Chechens and other Central Asian jihadists who are now sort of pledging their allegiance to ISIS. So I kind of thought maybe it was that group because it was in Russia itself and in Moscow. But just a few hours later, once the ISIS Khorasan claim responsibility came out, that put it in a very different context. So looking at where ISIS Khorasan began its journey as another one of these affiliates of ISIS core in Iraq and Syria, 2014, 2015, the first 5 or 6 years of its evolution, it was very locally and regionally focused, but still brutal, still violent, indiscriminate attacking ethnic and religious minorities in Afghanistan. If your listeners remember, they were responsible for the terrible suicide bombing at the Hamid Karzai Airport on August 26, 2021, when the US and NATO was trying to withdraw from the country once it became clear that the Taliban had either by that point assumed control or was about to assume control, and ISIS Khorasan struck then. And that's when they sort of came onto the broader international scene. But what we've seen these last couple of years is they've moved well beyond their immediate home base of South Asia. They have now conducted this terrible attack in Moscow. If your listeners remember, January 4th of this year, they were two suicide bombers killed themselves about 20, 30 minutes apart at a funeral procession in Kerman, Iran, for Qasem Soleimani, who was the head of the Iranian Republican Guard Quds Force. He was killed by the US in 2020, almost a 4 year anniversary of his death. And so those are two very distinctly different types of external attacks we have now seen. And then there have been disrupted plots in Europe from people with either direct ties or perhaps sympathetic to ISIS-K. both in Germany. One last December, five individuals were arrested. And just this week, before the news of the Moscow attack, two other individuals arrested in Germany. These two were of Afghan descent, apparently. And they were planning to, even though they're physically arrested in Germany, planning to attack the Swedish parliament. So ISIS, of course, on 10 years after its development or its evolution or from its origins, looks so different now, where it's able to project these type of complex plots either in the Middle East, into Eastern Europe with Russia, or into Western Europe with these arrests in Germany. And that's a very troubling development. And does it stop there? Do they have their eyes set on the homeland like Al-Qaeda did after or before 9/11? These are all really important questions that I would like to think my former colleagues in the counterterrorism and intelligence communities are thinking about right now.
So, I mean, for the average listener, right, for the general public who may not be as, well-versed or tracking national security or foreign policy developments, they may be like, well, I thought we defeated ISIS, a couple of years ago. President Trump has also said, he's defeated ISIS. And they may be surprised at like, oh, ISIS is still around. So, and, I'm sort of curious to sort of extrapolate a bit more on, ISIS-K as opposed to sort of, I mean, I don't know how to sort of word it, like generic ISIS, general ISIS. Like, how is ISIS-K, how has it sort of developed sort of separately from that broader ISIS, I guess, organization? And please correct me if I'm sort of looking at it the wrong way.
Well, a good analytic framework to think about is ISIS, what I would call core, much the way we called Al-Qaeda core, the Afghanistan and then Pakistan-based cadre of people who were the leaders of Al-Qaeda. The same thing happened with ISIS, but in a different part of the region. That their home base was Iraq and Syria, and they declared, unlike Al-Qaeda, an Islamic caliphate stretching that had sort of crossed the borders between Iraq and Syria, and they were holding enormous amounts of territory with millions of people underneath their control. And that's something Al-Qaeda never did. Al-Qaeda was never able to hold geographic territory, and certainly at that kind of level. And even Osama bin Laden never had the audacity to declare an Islamic caliphate over captured territory. Well, ISIS changed the game on that in the mid 2010s, and then it took a few years of a very aggressive counterterrorism campaign led by the U.S., but involving dozens of countries, and then local partners in Iraq and in Syria, not on the Syrian government side, but Syrian Kurdish fighters and other Syrian Arabs coming together to basically destroy ISIS's physical caliphate in Iraq in Syria. And President Trump, as you noted, Andre, tweeted that out, I believe, in 2018, and then also declared, ISIS was militarily defeated about a year later. And ISIS in Iraq and Syria was under a tremendous amount of pressure. They have thousands, if not more, of ISIS members killed or captured there. But ISIS was always bigger as a as an idea and potentially as an organization than just the main group in Iraq and Syria. And so there were at least a couple dozen jihadist groups in the mid 2010s that sort of took the ISIS brand and name and either invented themselves new or rebranded themselves from a different jihadist stripes. And now that notion of what is ISIS is very different. So yes, ISIS core in Iraq and Syria, they're probably not militarily defeated, but they don't present the same kind of threat. They've been pushed underground and much more of a local threat in Iraq and Syria. But a group like ISIS Khorasan that declared its allegiance to the main ISIS in Iraq and Syria a decade ago, they were also under a lot of military pressure from the U.S.-led coalition in Afghanistan. But with the withdrawal in 2021, and that was a pledge that President Biden made, that ability to keep the sustained pressure an intelligence focus of what ISIS Khorasan was doing in either Afghanistan or Pakistan, well, that's gone. And I don't think it's a coincidence that in these past few years now that you've seen this resurgent ISIS Khorasan that may not be bigger than it was a few years ago, but much more aggressive. That to me is the real key difference here, that ISIS is pushing plots so far outside of its traditional base of operations that this isn't something that the group was able to do when the Western military coalition and the Afghan government were working hand in glove to put pressure on them. Well, all those things, that dynamic is gone. And so the only element in Afghanistan that's able to put pressure on ISIS Khorasan or collect some kind of information or intelligence is the Taliban. And whether they want to do that in good faith or not, they clearly don't have the same kind of capabilities that the NATO-led coalition had and the Afghan government had. So this is another one of these reasons why I think ISIS Khorasan has emerged so differently, is that the Taliban can only do so much. And there might still be people in the Taliban based on, because there were a lot of former Afghan Taliban members, not a lot, but there were some former Afghan Taliban members who split off and joined ISIS Khorasan for a lot of different reasons, that, you know, how many of those longstanding either personal ties or organizational ties exist between ISIS Khorasan and people in the Afghan Taliban. And as long as ISIS Khorasan isn't willing to cause havoc in Afghanistan, although that remains an open question based on their track record, maybe the Afghan Taliban, who is, you know, trying to govern the country and not doing it very well, maybe they've made a deal with ISIS Khorasan. Well, we won't, because we can't put as much pressure on you, as long as you don't conduct attacks here, that you want to launch attacks against the West, then not that they have their blessing, but the Taliban will kind of look the other way. But that's also what got the Taliban in trouble pre-9/11, and what led to the you know, first the U.S. intervention, then the NATO coalition in Afghanistan. So the Taliban's in a really difficult place when it comes to ISIS Khorasan, because they're competing with them, and they can't just be passive about it, because if there is a major ISIS Khorasan attack in Europe, or worst case, if there's some attempted plot in the United States, it looks like the kind of attacks they've already been able to pull off. Well, one would think that the Biden administration is going to be forced with a difficult decision to go back into Afghanistan at some point. So those are all things that are that people need to think about when looking at this group. It's not just a local threat anymore. It has become a transnational one.
So, I mean, you know, I think when we talked about, you know, the 2021 pullout of Afghanistan, one of the big concerns was our ability to collect intelligence on, you know, potential terrorist activities that Al-Qaeda, that ISIS may be conducting in Afghanistan, maybe plotting in Afghanistan. However, you know, we did know. I mean, we essentially sort of called out this specific threat on March 7th. We warned the Russians, saying that there will be some extremist attack, specifically calling out the concert venues. So, you know, I'm sort of curious, like, have our intelligence capabilities been dealt such a blow with the pullout from Afghanistan, or, you know, do we still have some abilities, you know, as it seems that we did, to sort of identify where these plots, how these plots are being planned out?
Well, based on media reporting, it looks like there remains a capability to collect intelligence on ISIS Khorasan activity. You know, the degree of that, it's hard to know from the outside now looking in. But as you mentioned, the U.S. did apparently have a pretty high level of fidelity on this, because if you think about what was in the warning and then what happened, that was pretty accurate, other than time, place, and location, and the people identified. And who knows, like, maybe some of that was actually passed in private to the Russians, and the Russians just actually couldn't find the four people responsible for carrying out the attack. I mean, that would be fascinating if that actually comes to light. And again, I don't know if that happened or not. And Also, with the Iran attack in Kerman, Iran, on January 4th of this year, and this didn't really make the headlines at the time, although now there's some media reporting on it, is that apparently the same thing happened, that the U.S. did have some pretty accurate intelligence insights on a potential ISIS course on threat in Iran. And it was, based on the media reports I saw, passed to the Iranians, but they too weren't able to stop that attack from happening. Was it because they dismissed the intelligence because it was coming from the US, or they thought it was coming from the US? Did they not have the capability to disrupt the plot in advance? That plot involved two suicide bombers, not four people like in Moscow. So these are all things that are going to have to be looked at too. But even with the best intelligence in the world, if you can't do anything with it, that's the problem, right? And because we don't have a military presence on the ground, it's hard for the US and the West to take the action that it wants, armed with all this great intelligence. And this is the difficulty of the environment in Afghanistan post-withdrawal.
So another thing I'm sort of curious about is, you also mentioned we warned Iran, we warned Russia, two sort of key geopolitical adversaries, right? I mean, we're almost fighting proxy wars against these two countries, essentially. But we warned them, and from what I've been reading from other former intelligence officials, this is the norm. I mean, what type of is there a cooperation happening between, adversaries on counterterrorism issues? I'm sort of curious to, spend a little bit of time on that question.
Well, not there's no formal counterterrorism relationships with either Iran or Russia or even intelligence on any topics, whether it's counterterrorism or anything else. But when the U.S. does collect what it believes is credible threat information about plots, whether they're coming from ISIS, Al-Qaeda, pick a foreign terrorist group, there's a concept called duty to warn, and that can apply on the international side or certainly on the domestic side. And it's incumbent on the intelligence community to then either pass that intelligence in its fullest form possible. You can do that with close partners, or you have to sanitize it to a certain level to protect sources and methods, but still pass enough information to give a foreign government, even if a foreign government that is you're in an adversarial relationship with, and that is clearly the case with Russia and Iran, but it's up to those governments to then do something with the information the U.S. has provided to them, because we can't operate on their soil, nor would they let us. So we don't know in both cases, both in the Iran case and the Russia case, how was that U.S. intelligence acted on? And again, there are a million different ways to look at this, but if it was dismissed outright, then that is not a good news story for the victims of those attacks, because their governments were supplied information by the U.S. That theoretically could have assisted in the disruption of those plots before they happened. I don't. That's speculation on my part. I don't know if that was the case, but that's how that process generally works.
So why attack Russia? I mean, Russia's obviously been involved in Syria, other aspects of the Middle East, but I mean, like, Jabin, in your view, I mean, like, what's the motivation to attack Moscow, to attack such a target, and to, anger the Russian government, essentially? I mean, what is that motivation? What's that goal?
Well, that's a really interesting question. A lot of people are trying to answer that right now. And I, in some of the other interviews I've given on this subject, what I've tried to say is I think there are multiple factors at play here. One could be ideological, sort of fits these type of attacks still fit within the broader ISIS vision of exporting terror and chaos into all of ISIS's or against all of ISIS's enemies, whether that's Europe, whether that's the United States, whether that's in the region, locally in South Asia, or even in places like Russia. So it, at a broad level, it does fit within the vision for ISIS that its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, before he was killed in a U.S. raid in October 2019, that he laid out. So I'm not, that in and of itself doesn't seem to be that different. But I also think because of just the makeup of people within ISIS Khorasan, and it's not a monolithic group. There are former Afghan Taliban members in there. There are individuals with the Pakistani Taliban or a group called Tehrik-i Taliban that was very violent for several years and has kind of come back on the scene the last couple of years in Pakistan. There are Central Asian jihadists, Chechens, Tajiks, Uzbeks, who probably either had personal grievances or familiar or community ones against things the Russian or former Soviet government did to them. So I could see those being equally compelling factors too, just based on the makeup of ISIS Khorasan. And then there just could be questions about capability and access and ability to blend in and sort of plan a complex operation in an environment like Russia, because people are just familiar with the country and can speak the language and can act like locals or know the right people in a place like Russia to get logistics, to get weapons, to get travel documents. So those are things that also could be part of the equation as well. So I don't think there's a single factor. I think there are several that have combined to result in what happened in Moscow, but they did the same thing in Iran, and looks like they've tried to do the same thing twice in Germany, if not Sweden. So this, to me, the last year shows how ISIS is just transforming into something, a group that has a global outlook, but that's not only ideological, but is also operational. They could carry out these types of attacks, or they have the capability to carry out these attacks. And that's not the ISIS Khorasan that came onto the scene 10 years ago.
You know, and you know, when you talk about a global outlook, you know, obviously I don't want to speculate on, you know, who these four assailants were. There were varying reports that said, okay, these were citizens of Tajikistan. I think the Russian government had said that. There were some other reports that said, okay, like they were hired by like an ISIS guy to sort of do this. And obviously, you know, I don't necessarily trust all the information coming from Russia or the Russian government. But that sort of begs the broader question of, you know, like when ISIS-K does these attacks, are these, or at least in your observations, have these traditionally been like operatives, say, from Afghanistan, from that area, that locality that they are, you know, operating in, who are going out into the world and embedding themselves in these countries? Or are these sort of like homegrown extremists who are radicalized online or radicalized through, like, you know, various non-localized means, who are now conducting these attacks? You know, like, is it someone who's just sitting at home sort of being radicalized?
That's another great question. These external attacks, again, with a lot that we don't know, they do look more professional, to use that term in a negative way, in the sense, because they're not just involving one person. They involve, and all of them, the four plots that I talked about, the two that were successful, one in Moscow, one in Iran, and the two that were disrupted in Germany, all involved more than one person, all involved apparently the ability of people to travel outside of either Afghanistan or Pakistan to get then either to Germany or Iran or to Russia. Now, were in each one of those operations, you know, what was the identity of each person and the timeline of how they got trained and recruited and deployed? I don't think we've seen an accounting of that. Maybe it exists. I just haven't seen it. But it wouldn't surprise me that even in the Moscow attack, that the four who were picked had some background and familiarity with operating either in Russia and or the just the former Soviet republics or the former Soviet Union. And if you have the language capability, that could go a long way too. And the tactics, these are tactics, these active shooter tactics or commando assault tactics. ISIS scored, this is what they pulled off in Paris in 2015 with 9 people, only 2 or 3 of whom were actually trained by ISIS and then sent back. The other 6, at least involved in the direct plot, were more kind of homegrown and then kind of pulled into the plot, but still very lethal. So this is another interesting aspect. Are they pushing everybody out of Afghanistan, or is it a blend of what we saw in the 2010s with ISIS, where some people who've got the training in the home base, and others more who are local, but then can be added to the team just based on kind of social connections or kind of operational ones. But I don't believe in all of those these 4 external plots that these were people who are just self-radicalized or homegrown. This had much more of a organized and professional aspect to it.
So how actually, so you mentioned Paris, I think around like 2015. How does this attack parallel, what occurred in Paris back in 2015? But also, I mean, I sort of recall back in 08, the 2611 attacks in Mumbai, where, extremists went and stormed the hotel, sort of guns, heavy guns, sort of shooting all these people en masse and sort of taking control of that hotel, the Taj Hotel in Mumbai, for like a brief period of time. So, I mean, like, when you look at sort of those two attacks that are still very, it's still very much in the public conscious of those French publics and the Indian publics, do you see parallel similarities between, all three of these attacks in terms of the style? And the strategy.
Well, the Mumbai attacks in 2008 sort of opened the door in the jihadist world to planning those kind of operations. But that also was a bit different because it was the people involved in the Mumbai attacks were from this Pakistan-based group called Lashkar-e-Taiba, which for the most, again, very violent, very brutal, but for the most part focused its attacks on India, or Indian interests, and was not as transnationally focused, at least attacks in Europe, or the homeland. Or maybe they thought about it and they just weren't able to pull it off. But the commando style tactics, I mean, they used with devastating results. And but though in that attack, they or that operation, they split up into 2-man teams and two 5 2-man teams and fanned out into different parts of Mumbai, which I'm very familiar with, the areas in Mumbai which got attacked just based on my own upbringing and family connections to India. So that was sad to see. And then same kind of operational model that was carried out with the Paris attacks, multiple targets, some that were intended to be suicide attacks. If you remember the attacks outside the Stade de France, which 3 suicide bombers detonated themselves outside the stadium, even though I'm sure the original plot design was to try to go inside the stadium, but the rest of the attacks involved these roving gun teams that were driving in cars and basically just shooting people in cafes and then moving to other targets. How many of those were opportunistic versus how many were who planned? The majority of people who died in the Paris attacks, though, died in the Bataclan theater shooting, where 2, if not 3, members of that attack cell then got access to the theater, and just what it sounds like from the Moscow attack, were just indiscriminately shooting as many people as they could before then they got killed by French law enforcement. So in the Moscow attack, commando assault, seen that before in Mumbai, seen that in Paris. But I the difference though is of the 4 people, they all apparently stayed at that one venue in Moscow and committed the horrific attacks there. And then, and this is something I'm still struggling to explain, they got arrested and didn't kill themselves in the process. They didn't have suicide vests, or if they did, they weren't able to detonate them, or they just didn't wind up getting killed by firing back at law enforcement. So the fact that all four were captured is that is very different from what happened in Mumbai, where only one person survived the attack. And in Paris, a few either escaped and then were involved in other kind of plots. But usually the people who carry these type of assault attacks out wind up getting killed, or they kill themselves. That apparently didn't happen with the Moscow attack. Right now is the biggest difference. We'll find out more in terms of their backgrounds and identities and how they planned and trained and traveled. But at least for the fact of four being arrested, that is the big difference between the other two attacks we talked about.
And it's really surprising that they did kill themselves, considering they were arrested by the Russians, by the Russian law enforcement, and the Russian law enforcement, the Russian military is known to take more brutal tactics with, those they capture. So I think that's what has also genuinely surprised me. Javed, as we sort of close this interview out, do you sort of have any sort of final parting thoughts, maybe final myths that you need to bust for the general audience who are trying to make sense of the rapidly evolving news around this event?
Well, I do think this is a group that the international community is going to have to come up with a different game plan against because of the lack of the Western military presence in Afghanistan, and the fact that the Afghan Taliban just either doesn't have the capability or just doesn't have the mindset to be more aggressive against ISIS Khorasan. So in that vacuum, you can see what ISIS Khorasan is able to do. But I don't think we're going to hear the end of threats from this group. I think there are probably other plots they've been planning, whether in Europe or parts of the Middle East and South Asia. Let's hope there's nothing directed against us here in the US. This group isn't going away. They've been on the scene for 10 years. And even though ISIS main in Iraq and Syria is battered, bruised, damaged, this is another element within the broader ISIS enterprise that looks far, far more dangerous than it did years ago. And we just need to tackle it head on and not be complacent about it.
Javed, thank you so much for coming to join us here on such short notice. Terrible attacks, but we will be learning a lot more about these assailants, about ISIS-K, and about I think the global reaction, and I think the Russian reaction as well to this tragedy. But for now, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Andre, thanks so much. Always great to be with you, and great to see all the achievements you've had with the Burn Bag the last few years.
Thank you.